This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
Welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight we have the second part of my interview with Steph Young. And I wanted to address something that I see here and there, which is people comparing her to David Politis. Her work and David Politis' work are two completely different things. Although they're both dealing with occasionally missing people, and that's not all Steph deals with, David Politis takes a very methodical approach to what he's doing. He's looking for specific patterns in missing people. He's not just looking at anyone who's gone missing. He is looking for things that fit very specific criteria. Whereas Steph is looking at an overall picture, is collecting stories, is looking at as many different viewpoints as possible. And this makes both things very, very different from one another. There are very few cases where they have covered the same data, with the exception now of the drowning deaths of college students, which Steph was researching long before David Politis got into it. But again, David is looking for very specific patterns in these deaths, whereas Steph is looking at it as an overall phenomena. So the comparisons between the two are, well, wrong. They're really not there. They're two very different things. If you read Steph's books, you'll find they're nothing like David Politis's, and vice versa. So you have two different people approaching some similar information from completely different angles. And there will be one more part to this. I believe we'll be doing it next week, and it'll eventually come out as a midweek podcast where we're going to deal with the drowning deaths and all the research Steph has done on it over the last few years. But it was too big to just squeeze into the end of a show, so we're going to do it as its own show. And as I said, that will be a midweek podcast that you'll be able to get if you go to www.wheredidtheroadgo.com. It'll be available on our iTunes feed and on our YouTube and stuff. So, without any further ado, this is my conversation, part two of my conversation with Steph Young about her book, Hunted in the Woods.
All right, and tonight we welcome back to the show Steph Young. And we're still talking about the book we were talking about last week, Hunted in the Woods. And the subtitle is, Sometimes Predators Are Animal or Human, and Sometimes They Are Not. And I don't know why we thought last week we were going to get anywhere near through all these stories, which are just a fraction of what are actually in the book. This is, I think we mentioned this last week, but this is, I think, the longest book you've written so far, isn't it?
Yeah, I think they're getting longer and longer. Yes, because I always have so much left over that I kind of put to the side and think, okay, I really need to spend a lot more time on it and finish it off. But I end up getting more and more stuff. So they do get longer now, actually, yes.
And this is available only as an ebook on Amazon, right?
Well, actually, I have had them put into paperbacks. So they should be in Amazon now, because I'd had a few people saying, you know, they don't like reading them on Kindle, which is, you know, is true for some people. So I have, I've had them put into paperbacks now.
So they're all available on paperback?
Yes.
Okay. All right. And but they are only available on Amazon.
Sorry. Yes, they are just on Amazon.
Okay. So let's get into a few more of the stories from the book. How about the Green Children of Wolf Pit? I remember hearing about this one back when I was a kid.
Yeah.
It always fascinated me.
Yeah, I'd heard it before as well. Well, it seems that it was recorded by some 12th century texts, and there were a couple of people that wrote about the story. There was a monk called William of Newburgh and a man called Ralph of Cogshill, who was an abbot of the Augustine Priory there, and it happened in Bury St. Edmunds, which is in the county of Suffolk, in a very rural place. And it was during the reign of King Stephen. It was outside of the village itself, and it happened when the farmers were in the fields toiling and harvesting. And the field workers suddenly saw these two small children emerging from a very deep ravine. And the ravines had been built there specifically to keep the wolves away from the field. So when the wolves came out of the forest, they would fall into the ravine and not be able to get back up. But they saw these two children climbing out of it. And as the farm workers walked towards them, they thought this was really strange because the children looked like they were green. And as they got closer and closer, they noticed that their skin was glowing this green colour, and their clothes didn't seem to be from that era, and they looked more kind of cobwebby. So the villagers, the farm workers, said to the children, who are you? Where have you come from? But the children looked as shocked as the farm workers, and they were looking all around them as if they didn't know where they were. And the villagers said they were trying to talk to them, but the children couldn't answer them. And then eventually, when they did speak, they were talking in a language that the farm workers didn't understand. So eventually the farmers took the children into the village. And again, nobody could understand what they were saying. So they took them to the home of the Lord of the Manor, who was called Sir Richard de Calne. And there the servants gave them food and water, but the children refused to drink any of the water and they wouldn't eat. And this went on for several days. And then the farm workers had brought some of the food up to the farmhouse, to the Lord of the Manor's house. And the children eventually did eat some of the vegetables, but this was after several days. Anyway, they kept them there and they couldn't communicate with them, so they couldn't understand where they'd come from. And after a few months, it seems that the boy never really sort of came round properly, and he ended up dying, and they said that he was really unhappy. But the girl seemed to adjust better, and they both seemed to be less than 10 years old by the looks of them. But the girl managed to start learning the language, and when she could finally talk, there was a rumour that she ended up getting married, and it was said that she married an ambassador to the king. But now she could talk, she could actually say where she'd come from. And so she said, well, they came from a land that was permanently twilight and everyone was green. But she couldn't say where this land was. She could only say that she thought it was across a river. And they said, how did you come to be in the field? And she said, well, we had been looking after my father's cows, and some of them had gone off, and they went inside a cavern. And so the children followed them into the cavern. And inside, they started to hear some beautiful bells ringing, and they walked towards where they thought it was coming from. And when they arrived there, they were greeted by what looked like an entrance, but it was so bright that it stunned them, and it made them lay down, and they just lay there in a trance for a long time. And then she remembers nothing else until she was found with her brother walking in the field, and the farmers found them. And this was recorded by the monk, William of Newburgh, and he said it was as if they'd been fashioned, so as if they'd been made from summer leaves and soft green meadows. So he also said, and their skin was as green as the strange colour of their eyes. And he wrote that he was overwhelmed by the amount of competent witnesses. So as far as he was concerned, he'd verified the story and he'd spoken to all these people about it. And The only possible explanation that was given as an alternative to that they'd come out from a different land was that they could have got a condition called hyperchromic anemia, which comes about from a poor diet, and it can give your skin a slight greenish tinge. But then why had nobody else got that colour? Because I would imagine the diet would have been the same wherever they were. So nobody else around them had ever had that colour. And I suppose it also didn't explain the description of this land that they came from, you know, the Twilight Land. Right. And the sources seem to be valid because William of Newburgh as well, he was a canon at the Priory, and he'd written a book called Historia Rerum Anglicarum, which is the history of English affairs. And so it seemed, you know, at the time that it was a verified story, but it's a very strange one because of course, they didn't know really where the children had come from or whether it was true, but it's an intriguing story.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, it's a very unique story, too. You don't have any, as far as I can remember, I don't remember hearing any other stories about green children.
No, I don't either. I've read a couple of other stories where children have suddenly appeared and they've said they've been under the ground, but I haven't been able to find any verifiable sources for those ones, but I've never heard the green one, no.
Yeah, and it definitely sounds like either an inner Earth type of thing or possibly even another dimension.
Exactly, yes, it could be, couldn't it? Yeah, either.
So let's move on to 3-year-old Ramiro and the Little People.
Yeah, this was written about in 1977, and the issue of Fate magazine had covered the story, and their headline, it said, "Recent violent occurrences in Veracruz again have brought the Chancas into prominence." And it seemed that the story in question was featuring a little boy who was abducted and held in a cave in a thick forest. His mother had given the interview, and she was called Cirilla Laguenz, and she was a shop owner. And she was telling the magazine, she said, "My 3-year-old son Ramiro wandered from home and he was missing for 6 days. He was found by the Chancas. Instead of telling us, because they're very timid, they told our neighbour's young son that he could be found in a cave 10 miles away. So a search party went to the cave and they found my son, and he was asleep inside. And although he'd been gone for several days," she said, "he was in perfect health, he wasn't hungry, he wasn't thirsty, and he was not unhappy at all. And he quickly told them that he'd got lost, and he'd been near a river, and 5 little men had found him. And he said they'd taken him into the cave, and they'd given him food and milk, and then he'd gone to sleep. And when he woke up, he said that they were still in the cave, and they stayed with him, and they played games with him." And so she says, well, knowing that no one's going to believe this story that my son told, she says, "Of course my son, not wanting to be told off for staying away from home and getting lost, must have invented the tale. You know, not wanting to be told off. But it's not that simple." She said, "He's a little young to invent this story. But more than that, the entire hillside where the cave is, right up to the mouth of the cave, is covered with extremely dense shrub, and it's 5 feet tall, and it's got spines and limbs. And," she said, "the rescuers who went there to get my son had to cut their way into the cave to reach him. They all had bruises and scratches, and some even had puncture wounds on their arms and their legs. So my son, who was barefoot and bare-legged when he went, missing, was found without a single mark on him." And she said, "It's also foolish to say that his friend had brought the food and drink to him when he was in the cave for all those days he was gone, because not only was the cave inaccessible, but it was an 18-mile round trip." And then the editor of the magazine says, "Well, this is similar to the accounts that we've had sent in to us over the years about the caverns in Phoenix, in the East Phoenix area in the southwestern New Mexico." And he said that ranchers have seen these little men standing like sentinels on the ridges, and have reportedly said that they lead children out of dangerous areas. I hadn't read that before, but it reminded me of, in one of my other books, the Dark Watchers that people said that they've seen on those ridges. But the Dark Watchers are supposed to be these huge, up to 11 feet tall, shadow-looking beings. So that was interesting.
Yeah, I mean, anything with little people always fascinates me, just because, I mean, they're so prevalent in so many things all throughout our culture and history.
Exactly, I mean, they
seem to exist in some way.
There are
maybe not in a literal way. They may not exist like we exist, but they might exist they obviously exist somehow, or we shouldn't have all these stories.
Well, there are so many accounts, aren't there, going back to from years and years ago, particularly with the fairy sightings, and they're little men or little people or little gnomes. There are so many ancient accounts, which perhaps some have been made up, but then why are there so many? Like you say, they're so prevalent.
And cross-culture.
Yes, yeah.
And of course, you know, it ties all into the whole UFO phenomena, because most of the time you find small beings on you know, when people encounter UFO occupants. I mean, occasionally they're giants, but more often than not, you know, they're small.
Yeah.
They're little people.
They are, aren't they? And in a way, well, I mean, in this story, you know, they sound like they were very benevolent and very kind. And and you kind of think, well, if they're just little, how could you be scared of them, you know? But then it must be pretty weird to come across a group of little people.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Yeah. And fairies were known to be either kind or malicious, too.
Yeah. Played lots of tricks on people, didn't they? Yeah.
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 So let's move on to Señor R. Gutierrez.
This one, yes. Well, this was a couple of years beforehand, and it was, again, in the same kind of region. So this man was out in the forest. It was 1970, and it was summer, and he was walking with his little nephew called Arto, and he was in the Mextequila in Veracruz in the forest. And they were walking along having a chat, and then he suddenly realized that the boy was not there. So as soon as he realized it, he immediately began to search the area, and he could find no sign of the boy, and he was shouting out, but he got no response to his calls. So after this quick search, he ran back to the village, and he gathered everybody and got them to go into the forest to have a look for the boy. And they spent the whole day trying to find him, but they saw no sign of him at all. And the authorities then went and did a search, and they couldn't find him. And as a result, the man was actually put, he was arrested for murder of the boy.
Sure.
And it was a month went by, and he was on bail waiting for the start of the trial. And then the little boy, after 30 days, he just walked back into the house, and he was completely unharmed. And again, he looked as though he'd been really well looked after and fed. He was completely clean, even his shoes, and he was not in any distress at all. And the uncle said, well, when we asked him where he'd been all this time, he said, I've been with the little men, and they gave me honey and milk, and we played lots of games. And and the authorities dropped the murder charge, obviously, because he'd returned. And they sort of thought, well, there's nothing really more to investigate here. And fate, the editors, they actually went and investigated and, you know, checked with the police and said, is this true? And they said, yes, that's the story as it seems to be. So they left it at that.
And Joshua Cutchin had done his entire book, A Trojan Feast, is based on the offerings of different foods and stuff from these type of entities, and the milk and honey fits right in with the common themes that he's found.
I've read some of his book. It's fascinating. It's really, really good. Yeah. So many accounts in it, isn't there, of these kind of experiences?
Well, and one of the things I found interesting that he said is as he got further and further into doing this, he would hear a story, you know, it start out, however, and he'd be able to predict what they gave them.
Oh,
you know, based on the context of the story. And he's like, okay, there's definitely a pattern here if I can predict without, you know, reading that part, what type of substances they're going to give them.
That's amazing. Did he get to the bottom of any of it?
No, but it definitely adds to the weirdness of the whole situation.
Yeah, it's a very good book, actually. Yeah.
So, all right. So now you've written a little bit on Black Mountain, which is in Australia, and there was there's actually a movie about this.
Oh, is there?
Yes. I can't remember the name. It's a Picnic at Looking or Hanging Rock, I think.
Well, you know, that's not a true story.
It's
the Picnic at Hanging Rock.
Oh, I know.
Oh,
I know.
Oh, right. Okay. Because I thought it was. No, I actually believed it was, and it was only when I looked into it that I realized it was fiction. But there's also other people that say, well, it happened and they fictionalized it. So well, in the Black Mountain, which is in New South Wales, Australia, the area there is full of boulders and caverns and tunnels, and it's said to be a site that has a lot of supernatural phenomenon. And there's numerous accounts of mysterious disappearances of animals and also people. And there've been reports of people who've completely disappeared and never been seen again. And of course, the people have gone out to search for them. And that's what's given the Black Mountain the name, the Mountain of Death. And it does have a strange geography because there's enormous boulders there that are black, and they were formed from magma millions of years ago. But the indigenous people there, they refuse to go near it because just the appearance alone is quite sinister, but they are far more superstitious about it, and they avoid it, you know, at all costs. But there have been a range of different types of reports that come out from there, and they vary from strange sounds that come from underneath the ground to sightings of human-like shadows that are fleeting. But it is also supposed to be an area of turbulence when people fly over it as well. And, of course, it's a lot of UFO activity there. Well, underneath the boulders are these tunnels and caverns, and it's said that sounds of crying and moaning comes out of it. Well, it could be the flow of the air moving naturally through, but the indigenous people believe it's the home of an ancient underground race. And there are, you know, a lot of tales, and one of them relates to a farmhand called Hearty Owens, and he was out on the mountain and he was looking for the cattle after they disappeared. And when he didn't come back to the farm, his farm manager, Mr. Hawkins, he went back to the mountain to look for the missing farmhand and the cows, and he took some police with him. When they got there, they decided they should search some of the caverns in case somehow they'd fallen down. And two of the policemen went down into one of the caves, but only one of them came back. And it was said that when he came back, he was absolutely ghastly white and he was shaking. And he was never able to talk about what it was that he'd seen down in the cave. And neither the other policeman nor the farm worker ever came back.
Hmm. Yeah, and that was when?
Oh, I think that was in the 80s. I'm sorry, I've got it written down, but I think it was in the 80s.
Hmm. Yeah, that area is definitely very odd. And the movie was I think, captured it nicely.
Oh.
You know, I mean, even though it wasn't the actual, you know, events
on
Picnic and Hanging Rock, I think it did a good job of capturing that feel of how weird that area is.
Oh, did it? Oh, I should watch it. Oh.
Yeah, it's decent. I mean, it was done in, I think, the 1970s.
Right.
So, it's a little slow, but as long as you don't mind that.
But atmospheric.
Yes. Oh. And it's just about these girls who go on a picnic at the Black Mountain, and some of them disappear.
Oh.
So let's move over to the northeast of the U.S. here in the Bridgewater Triangle in Massachusetts.
Yes.
Which itself has had a lot of weird things happening in it.
It seems to have done, yes. It's supposed to be an area that's rife with reports that range anywhere from alien activity to unidentified cryptids. The Freetown Forest itself is the darkest area, really, and it's believed that a lot of the activities are more of a human origin because they're possibly linked to satanic worship inside the forest. And there have been quite a few murders in there and rumors of satanic cults using it as a conjuring ground, but also as a hunting ground. There was, for example, a teenage girl was found in the 70s, Mary Aruda, and she'd been snatched and taken in there and left for dead. And another time a man was found in there really badly beaten, and he told the police that he'd been attacked by this group of Satanists who tried to kill him. And another man was found naked and running around with stab wounds, and he'd fled the forest and gone to the nearest house for help. So, you know, there's things that have possibly gone on in there that have helped contribute to that atmosphere. And maybe people who go in there are not perhaps aware of that reputation with the black magic. And it reminds me of the Clapham Woods in Sussex, where, again, there's supposed to have been a lot of activity in there that perhaps has led to the manifestation of things. Because there have been reports of people hearing disembodied voices that sound to them, you know, pretty demonic, and they're very close to them. But when they look around, they can't see anybody there. And a man was once fishing in one of the pools there, and he said that it was early evening, so it was just sort of twilight, and he saw a group of people in the distance approaching him, and he thought nothing of it, and he carried on looking at his fishing rod. And when he looked back again, just only moments later, they'd completely disappeared, but out of the corner of his eye, he could see in a completely different direction, and they were just standing there staring at him. So that obviously made him leave pretty quick.
Yeah.
But also car drivers as well have come out with reports that when they've been driving past the forest, they've seen these strange figures at the edge of the forest. And some have even said that these dark shapes have appeared to run alongside the car and keep pace with the car as they drive along.
I'm forgetting the name of the group. I had interviewed a couple girls who did a paranormal group up in that area.
Mm.
I seem to remember them telling me a story, and it's on the site somewhere. It's a short interview with them, a video interview. So it's probably in the video section of wheretheroadgo.com. And they were saying something about hands coming up on the windows as they were driving through.
Oh, really?
But I don't remember it. It was about a year and a half ago I did the interview, and it was a short, like, 10-minute interview, and I don't remember the exact details, but I remember thinking it was a pretty freaky story.
Oh, well, that reminds me of, in England, we've got the Dartmoor Moors, so it's a national park, and it's pretty barren, but it's a really popular place to go for holidays, and it's just really long roads that you can drive through, and there's a recurring theme there about hands, and it's really spooky, and I think I put it in one of the other books, and it's that people drive along, and then all of a sudden, they see these hairy, huge, giant hands appearing on the windscreen. With nothing else, yeah. And there was a boyfriend and a girlfriend were camping there once, and they parked up for the night, and it was dark, and they were just sitting there chatting, and these huge hands appeared on the windscreen. It just terrified them. And there were lots of accounts in that specific area where people have been killed, actually, because they've been riding their motorbikes or bicycles, and something has grabbed hold of the handlebars, and they've crashed into walls, and been several, apparently, even fatalities. And one of the witnesses I remember was an army captain, and he said, you know, I serve in the army, I'm completely rational and sane, but something grabbed the handlebars of my motorbike, and it made me crash into that wall, and I'm lucky to be alive.
Wow.
Yeah.
And the other thing with stuff like this, when they talk about the satanic cults, and I don't doubt there are people out there who would do stuff like that. But I also wonder sometimes if they're apparitions as well when people see this stuff. You know, people see a bunch of robed people,
yeah.
Well, it could be robed people, but what if it's also just another part of this phenomena?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
You know, it's displaying this, you know, the same way it's displaying a weird cryptid.
Well, yes, yeah. Mm.
So, but yeah, this is the Bridgewater Triangle is definitely a big subject as far as weirdness goes.
Well, it also has that ledge, doesn't it? Assanet Ledge, where people have had that impulse to throw themselves off.
Really? That's in the Bridgewater Triangle?
Yeah, in Freetown Forest. Yeah.
Huh.
They go there. I found about 17 accounts, and they go there. They're absolutely fine. They've gone just for a walk and they're all happy. And then suddenly people have said, I've got this horrific urge to throw myself off.
Wow.
Yeah.
I've heard about that. I, for some reason, I thought it was in the UK. Huh.
No, it's, I'm sure it was in my first book. It's definitely Freetown Forest. It's called Assanet Ledge.
Hmm.
Where in the UK do you think there was one?
Oh, I don't remember. I remember hearing about the ledge, and I thought it was in the UK for some reason. Yeah, that's something someday I kind of want to make a road trip out to that area and see if, you know, anything weird happens.
Very interesting, isn't it?
Ballyboley Forest is another area with some weirdness, and that's in Northern Ireland.
Yes, and I wrote about this previously because it's a very intriguing forest. It's not actually that big. It's, it's 666 hectares, but it's not the size of a huge national forest. But it's a place where there's some really mysterious stone formations and circular trenches that are embedded in the ground. So it gives rise to the belief that it's an ancient druid site. and there are ancient texts that speak of it as a druid site. But the belief is that it was a gateway to the other world, according to Celtic tradition. But the Park Service maintain the trails there for the visitors to use, but there's particular paths that always stay clear of any foliage or branches, so they never have to actually clear that path because it's always clear. And the local people sort of don't like going in there very much because of the stories. And there's a few stories of people who have been in there, kind of what you were saying just now, but people see these dark figures standing amongst the trees, and they're wearing dark robes, and their heads are covered by cowls. So it looks like they're the druids. And there are, as I say, mentions of it in texts that are really old about people going into that part of the forest and never coming back. And in the 90s, the Irish newspapers reported on a couple of incidents where a husband and wife had gone into the forest and they suddenly heard this screaming. And moments later, they had this huge apparition of a dark shadow appearing in front of them. And then 2 or 3 years later, two men had gone into the forest and they were walking through it and they heard a really loud flapping sound, like it was some kind of giant bird, that sort of noise. But they didn't know what it was and they thought, well, we'll just ignore it, we'll carry on walking. And then moments later, they started hearing what sounded like a woman crying and moaning in pain or some kind of distress. So they were really worried and they looked around to try and find her, and they walked towards where the noise was coming from. But there was nobody there. But instead, what they did see was that the trees all around them appeared to be covered in blood. And so they ran, and as they turned back, as they were running, and they said that they could see these figures in dark cloaks standing where the trees with all the blood was. And then I had been continuing to try and find more accounts of the forest, and I found an account that was written in 2005 by a girl who had actually gone in there as part of the Duke of Edinburgh award scheme. And that's a bit like the scouts or the guides. It's where you go on an expedition in the forest and you'll camp there and you'll do things like compass work and navigation, so you could then get your badge for it. So they'd all gone there as a group, and she was 13 at the time, and they'd spent the day hill walking and using the navigation skills, and then they camped, and the first night passed absolutely fine. In the second day they went out navigating again, and they came back and they were sitting around having dinner by the campfire and just playing games. But she said on our last night, which was this night, they were all sitting as a group when they suddenly thought that they could see figures in the distance between the trees. And so two or three of them went towards the figures to try and see what they were, but they seemed to disappear as they got closer. So they went back and they had their hot chocolate, and then they all settled down for bed and nothing happened. And they got up the next morning, but one of the girls was still really distressed about something, and they said to her, "What's the matter?" And she said, "Well, didn't you hear what was going on? I was terrified last night." And she said, "I could hear all these squeals and cries." And the girl who was writing the account said, well, she would know what she was talking about because she lived on a farm. And the girl who had heard it said it sounded like an abattoir. It sounded like animals in an abattoir that was coming from the woods. But nobody else had heard it. So, and there's a lot, you know, I've got a lot of these kind of accounts. And I do have a thing for finding these ones where people hear screams or something invisible is there, but they can't see it, but something is going on, because they're so intriguing.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And just saying about that account, it wasn't foxes, because, I mean, foxes make a horrific noise, but she knew the sound of animals, and we don't have, you know, pumas or lions or anything in Ireland, so I don't know what it was.
I'm trying to remember, I know Ghost Adventures had done a show up in that, I don't remember where it was.
Yeah.
But I remember them getting a woman's voice on camera when they had stopped it at some point. That was really creepy.
Oh.
And I'm sure someone listening is going, oh yeah, that was such and such a thing. But it was like last year or something. And I just remember it because it was such a clear woman's voice. I mean, granted, it's a reality TV show. They could have faked it, but it their reaction didn't seem fake.
Okay.
I mean, they were really freaked out about it. And I'm wondering if it was that area.
Quite possibly.
I know there was some satanic stuff associated.
Right.
And they had a bunch of stuff that supposedly freaked them out, but yeah. That's what it brought to mind anyway.
Well, quite possibly it was there then.
So, all right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Steph Young.
Where Did the Road Go can be heard first and usually live on WVBR, Saturday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern. Go to wheredidtheroadgo.com to ask questions of our live guests through the chat room. Where Did the Road Go is then re-aired on Dark Matter Radio and Deprogrammed Radio. You can download all shows for free on the website, and you can subscribe to us on Stitcher, iTunes, YouTube, or Vimeo. Additional content can be found on our video channels. You will also find our upcoming schedule, book reviews, blogs, free book downloads, links, and more. We are also on Facebook and Twitter, and if you want to help support the show, there are links to donate to us. Everything you need can be found at wheredidtheroadgo.com.
All right, we're talking tonight with Steph Young, and we should clarify, too, that your books, if people are looking for them, are under Stephen Young.
They are, yes.
You had used a pen name initially.
I used a pen name initially, and I kind of deeply regret it now, but the thing was I didn't actually expect that many people would read them. I didn't imagine that they would become popular, so I used that pen name, and it was kind of too late to change it, so, yeah.
All right, well, it's easy enough to find. People can just look for Stephen Young if they're having trouble finding your books on Amazon.
Okay.
And let's see. What are we up to here on this list? Because as I went through your book, I gave you a list of things I wanted you to talk about.
I think it was Pluckley.
Yeah, I think it was. The woods surrounding the most haunted. Is the most haunted area in England.
Well, it is. According to the Guinness Book of Records, it's the most haunted place in England. And it's a... village. It's very small and it's in Ashford County, which is in Kent in the south of England. It was founded back in the 19th century and there's evidence of Bronze Age, Iron Age and Roman occupation. So it's very ancient and it sits actually on the edge of what's called the Andred's Weald, which is an ancient Saxon forest. And the forest stretches all the way down the south coast, down as far as the Isle of Wight, and is mentioned in the Domesday Book. There's Anglo-Saxon accounts from AD 447, and they talk about how the Anglo-Saxons invaded and the British were forced into the forest and had really serious battles in there. They went in there to seek refuge, but of course the soldiers advanced. And so it's a scene where there were a lot of battles going on. And in the Middle Ages, though, it became also a hiding place and a place of attack for highwaymen. And there was a really famous one called Robert Dubois. The thing about the forest is that, again, there are frequent blood-curdling screams that come from the woods. And it's heard by the villagers, but they're probably used to it by now. But when they go into the woods, there's never anybody in there. So they hear this screaming coming out. And people who have gone into the woods have said that they've been followed by an ominous black shadow. And they've often heard the sound of footsteps, which have been nearby, but of course, again, when they look, there's nobody there. Well, in one spot in the woods, back in the 18th century, this highwayman was caught, and it seems the story is that he'd attempted to hold up a coach of passengers, but they had fought back, and they used his own sword to impale him to a tree, tied him up, and left him to die there. So, of course, he's perhaps, you know, one of the entities that's supposed to be roaming the woods, but there's other stories as well. The apparition of a man's body is sometimes seen hanging from a tree, and it's said to be that of an old schoolmaster, and he committed suicide or he was taken there and killed. And the true version is not known because he simply went missing and was never seen again until a few weeks later when his body was found hanging in the woods. Yeah. There's also a disused clay pit. And an industrial accident, when it was being used, resulted in a worker being trapped there as the clay covered him over and it suffocated him. So again, there's the idea that perhaps it's his spirit that wanders. But I was looking for accounts, really, of people's experiences in there. And I found one of a female who had written it, and she was going in there, a bunch of teenagers, so a few girls, a few boys, and they went into the woods and they were all happy and the atmosphere was great and they were having a good time and they could hear the birds and the animals. And but as they got deeper into the woods, it seemed that everything suddenly went quiet. And she said it was so quiet you could hear a pin drop. And that's when the girls got really spooked and they thought, we're going to go back to the car. So they walked back to the car pretty quick and got back in. But the boys said, no, we're going to carry on. We're going to walk in the forest. But as they carried on going deeper into it, the girls sat there in the car and thought, well, there'll probably be a couple of hours now. But about 10 minutes later, they come running back through the forest and running, and they were jostling each other, trying to get back into the car as quickly as they could. And their faces were absolutely white. And they tried to start the car up, but it was stalling and it wouldn't work properly. And they started screaming. But they all of them said that they could see this huge black mist that was coming from the woods. But as it got slightly closer, it started walking. So it morphed from a big black mist into a kind of a shape that could walk, which is really strange.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. And that kind of leads... actually, I wonder how the Guinness Book of World Records decided that was a haunted area. Like, do they just count number of reports? Or?
Apparently, they counted the number of ghosts. And they said that they had 17 ghosts that were resident there.
That's it? Just 17?
That's all, yeah.
Seems like there should be someone else that can beat that record.
Yes, I don't know how they verified that one, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe there's another place that's got 20.
So that kind of leads us into the whole silence and other invisible things in the woods, which I've had my own personal experiences with.
You have, haven't you?
Yeah.
Yes. So you know a lot about these. Well, again, I really wanted to collect lots of accounts about these. And there was a lady called S. Vince, and she was... It was the summer of 2010, and she was in the woods behind her parents' home with her brother, and it was Butler County, Pennsylvania. They were in their late teens, but she said, we're both confident people, and I firmly believe in logic, and I do not get spooked, because I believe there's a logical explanation for everything, but that was how I felt then, but I don't feel that now. And they had gone into the woods with an axe and they were going to have a bonfire, so they were just looking for firewood. And it was a warm, sunny summer day and the wind was low, and they'd been in the woods thousands of times. So they went along the path and then they started to venture deeper into the woods to get this firewood. And they both commented how loud the sounds were, so all of the birds and the animals scurrying around. But after about 10 minutes, they found the trees with the dead wood that they thought would be ideal for the firewood, and they went to collect it. But as soon as they stepped into that particular area, everything suddenly went quiet. So the birds disappeared completely. But what came out instead were really, really loud insect sounds and the clouds that just came out of nowhere. So they felt very unnerved, but they kept gathering the firewood. But that really only lasted for less than a minute, because the sensation that she started to get on her body was that every hair stood up. And when she looked at her brother, she could see from his face that he was feeling exactly the same thing. And they took a look around, but everything appeared normal, apart from the fact that the birds and the animals were making no sound and the fact that the insects were really loud, but everything else was normal. So they laughed it off and they carried on what they were doing. And she said, you know, it felt like half an hour, but actually it was probably just seconds that I looked back around again. And this time the wind had completely gone. Every sound had stopped. And the air was dead, she said. And then she didn't know how or why, but she started getting pins and needles all up and down her spine. And she said, all I know is that there was something there, something was behind us, and we could feel its presence, and it did not want us there. And they exchanged really frantic looks between them, but she felt frozen, that she just couldn't move. And she said, the feeling of pure dread was all I felt. I felt like I was in a vacuum, and I was paralyzed, and I everything was in slow motion, and I couldn't move. But fortunately, her brother kind of broke the trance, and he started to run, and so, of course, she ran behind him. And she says, to this day, I don't understand what happened. They'd been in the woods thousands of times. Nothing was out of the ordinary, but it was an innate sensation that overcame them. It was nothing that they saw. They didn't hear anything, but they just felt it. And it's inexplicable, really.
Yeah, yeah. And there's lots of stories of like that weird silence or people feeling like something is watching them in the woods.
Mm.
And people connect it to, you know, I mean, some people connect it to Bigfoot, some people connect it to, you know, evil entities. But when they're invisible, it's really hard to exactly what you're dealing with.
Exactly. I'm going to put some of this in the book I'm working on now, but I'd read quite a bit about, I cannot remember his name, but he's called the psychic Sasquatch. He's a doctoral person, and he studies psychically, communicates with Sasquatch. But right, he also claims that nature entities communicate with him. And he has written something very, very interesting about an explanation as to why people go missing. And I'm currently working through that because I really want to sort of get to the bottom of that and be able to talk about it. But it's very, very interesting, and I was very taken with how he described it.
You don't want to get into that yet, do you?
I haven't finished it, Soraya. So I've I haven't got to the bottom of it. Sorry.
But I mean, for his explanation, do you want to get into that a little bit?
Well, the explanation really is that these entities communicate with him. So not only does Sasquatch communicate with him psychically, so he can hear and he can communicate and talk to them and they talk back, but these entities that are not actually Sasquatch, they're not a Wendigo as such, although I think he claims to talk to one, actually, they're nature spirits. And right. They actually explain a lot about the memory of the landscape and the effect that the human interaction, so let's say deforestation and things like that, so the human footprint has had a negative impact on these nature spirits, and they explain to him. And it also incorporates a lot of information about vortexes. So there are, in his opinion, from having communicated with these spirits, there are vortexes that naturally occur within these certain areas. And that's the sort of thesis that he has. As okay. I say, I would like to be able to explain it a lot better. It's very intriguing.
Right. Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, it is very interesting. And I know it's very easy to mock and say, well, you know, of course you can't speak to Sasquatch. And, but, you know, because we can't, it doesn't mean that somebody else can't. I can't.
Not only that, but he might be talking to something that's claiming to be Sasquatch and really isn't. Who knows?
Well, yeah, again, that's possible. He does talk about the malevolent side that some of these entities who talk to him do admit to having a malevolent side, and they explain why they have it as well.
Well, we have malevolent sides. There's no reason to think that anything else out there isn't going to have two sides to it, you know?
Oh, well, absolutely, yeah. You get good and bad in people, don't you? So, yeah, you could certainly have it in entities, yeah.
I would think it would be weird if we didn't.
But I suppose I've always kind of, traditionally, I sort of thought, you know, there's good spirits and there's bad ones. But you're absolutely right. Why couldn't they have a range of emotions like we have?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, with the fairy faith, you see that where the fairies could be kind to you, or, you know, you could insult them and they'll turn malevolent against you, and they're the same fairies.
Yeah, and you don't even know what you've done, but you've upset them.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Now one closer to where I am is the Ninham Mountain State Forest in Caramel, New York. I didn't know anything about this, so I'm kind of glad you wrote about this. And maybe, again, this is something I might eventually take a road trip to and see if I can pick up anything unusual.
Well, yeah, because there are evidence of druid chambers, burial chambers there in the Ninham. Is that how you say it? Ninham Mountain?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, so that's the state forest there, and it's in Carmel, New York State. And uh-huh. There are supposed to be these burial chambers that have been there for a very long time. And there's a sort of an argument about whether they're druid burial chambers or whether they were perhaps put there as traditionally used for, let's say, meat storage, you know, with people that move to the area. So I don't know. I think they probably are druid chambers. But so the reports that come out of there are very strange again, because it seems to be an area that has affected visitors, hikers and walkers, from anything ranging from hearing very strange voices calling to them, again, in languages they don't understand, which people have said, well, maybe this harks back to these druid people, But also there's a feeling of unreality that quite often overtakes them when they're there. And they also have very strange visions sometimes. So they've got voices, they've got visions, they've got a feeling that they don't really know where they are. And also reports of extreme vertigo taking over them as well. Now, for about a decade, Phil Imbrugio and a lady called Marianne Horrigan spent a lot of time investigating the chambers and the sort of aura there on the mountain. And they said that they were contacted by a man who said that he was an ex-military, had been serving in the military for years and years, but he'd also been a very keen camper, and he hunted and camped a lot on that mountain. So he did it for decades. And when it was 1992 and it was January, and he decided to go up to the mountain for just a hike on his own. So he started going up through the woods, and after an hour or so, he made it up to the top. But by the time he got up to the top, it really felt like it was about 40 degrees below. And of course, it was January and it was pretty cold. But he thought, well, you know, I'll get back down, it'll be okay. But then it started to snow really heavily, and the cold really seemed to affect him very quickly, and he felt that his hands had gone completely numb, and he couldn't really see very well either, because the snow, of course, was in the way. And he started to get lost, and he was feeling disoriented, and his legs felt like they were completely frozen up, and he was sort of looking around, and of course there was no shelter up there because the trees didn't have any leaves on them, and so it was just hitting him, and he eventually just fell to the floor because he felt so dizzy and so cold, and he lay on the floor and he just thought, well, I'm going to freeze to death and I'm going to die here, I'm going to have to accept it. And as he still had his eyes open, he said that he could see these strange lights coming towards him through the snow. And they were different coloured lights, and they were coming closer and closer, but there was no sound at all. But it was descending right up close to him. And at that point, he blacked out. Now, the next thing he remembers is that he was at the bottom of the mountain and he was inside the ranger's station. And the ranger was saying to him, this is really odd, you know, because the hiker was saying, well, how did I get here? I don't remember coming back down the mountain. And the ranger said, well, it's odder than that. I found you lying on top of the hood of a car in the car park. And the man said, well, I don't understand that. And the ranger said, well, even more than that, I had a telephone call and somebody told me that you were lying on the hood of a car. Yeah. And the man said, well, I don't even think I could have got down the mountain. The state I was in, I couldn't have got down there. I thought I was going to die. I thought I was going to die of frostbite or hypothermia. And he said, but, you know, I did have a very strange dream. And he said, I think I've lost about 40 minutes of my time, but I had a very strange dream. And I remember being in a room, and the room was just white and empty, but there were canisters, tall canisters in there. And inside the canisters, there were figures, and they really looked like people. And he said, in this dream, I remember feeling that there was a canister empty there. And the problem is now, and now he's recalling the story later, and he says that the really worrying thing now is that I feel that whoever they were, they're going to come back for me, because that canister was empty and I'm supposed to be in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a weird one.
It's very creepy. Yes. So, I mean, he says, you know, in this dream, but clearly that's how he could sort of frame it. But to him, it felt very real. And
there are other UFO sightings apparently around this area as well.
Are there?
Well, that's what you started the segment with.
Oh, right. Sorry. Yeah. Well, yes. Yeah. Sorry. I was thinking of something else. Sorry. Yeah. Yeah.
So that's interesting. I mean, it's something I might have to check out at some point, see if we can find any of this stuff.
Very interesting.
I mean, even just to videotape the chambers and stuff would be interesting to check those out.
Yes, they look absolutely fascinating. And I think they have done sort of EVP tests and things in them as well.
Hmm.
Yeah.
All right. So then there's the disappearance of Marcus Salvione.
Yes. Well, this was described as the biggest mystery Brazil has ever known. And in the newspapers, it was saying that it had gripped the nation entirely. And it happened back in 1985. on August the 6th, and a small group of scouts had gone to the forested mountains just outside the city of Piquet, which is outside of Sao Paulo. And there was a scout leader and four scouts, and one of those scouts was Marcus. But they went into the mountains, but only three of the scouts came back. And Marcus completely disappeared, and the newspapers said that it was, to them, seemed an entirely supernatural disappearance because they couldn't understand it at all. They had been going up on a trek, and they'd started from the base, obviously, but they said to the guide, well, it's a really well-marked path, and actually loads of tourists use it, so we don't need you. So they took the trail upwards, and they got to the top. But as they were ascending, one of the scouts slipped and he dislocated a knee. And so the scout leader said, well, it's going to be a real job getting you back down, because they were having to sort of have him between the two other scouts and an arm over each shoulder. And it was difficult to carry him all the way down. So he suggested one of them go back and get a stretcher. So Marcus volunteered, and the scout leader said, well, you can go, but make sure that you leave marks on the mountain on the way down. And their group, the scout group, was called 240. So he said, use your chalk and leave markers, put 240 as you're going down. So Marcus went, and a few hours later, the rest of the scout group with the injured boy got back to the base, back to the bottom. But Marcus wasn't there. And this was now 5 a.m. and they couldn't understand why the boy hadn't come back up. Well, when they set out, obviously, back up the mountain with the guide and as many volunteers as possible, they had also alerted, obviously, the police, but they also got the military involved. So this search for the boy went on for 28 days, helicopter dogs, all of that, really going over with a fine tooth comb. But they found no trace of the boy. They found no clothes, no water bottle, no little knife, no equipment. All they found were two markers, so two lots of 240, and then it's like he evaporated. And the search was so thorough that one of the soldiers who'd gone back in day after day had lost a knife, and they found the knife again and the next day. So that's how intricately they were looking.
Right.
And one of the searchers said to the parents of the boy, and the father was actually a journalist himself, and they said to them, well, do you believe in flying saucers? And they said, there's an Air Force general and he communicates with ETs. So he said, you must go and speak to them. But the parents were a bit sceptical, but obviously they were desperate. So they did go and speak to the general, but he said to them, I can't tell you anything. Now, I had to go through translations and things because it was in Brazilian, in Portuguese. But I couldn't find anything that meant he wasn't prepared to tell them. What it meant was, I think, was that he didn't get any information about it. So he couldn't tell them. Well, the newspapers and the TVs were following this case for months and months. And they had specialist teams who literally stayed in the forest and continually searched for the boy. But they'd never found anything. And the guide, you know, has got 50 years experience, and he couldn't find anything, and no clues at all. Well, a few years later, an investigative journalist wrote a book called Operation Marins, and he went back over the case. And he literally did a time-by-time, pinpointed every sort of last movement. And what was odd, I suppose, is that he was last seen at 2:40, and yet he left the markers for 2:40 as well, which I suppose is just a coincidence. Well, he had gone down the trail that they expected him to go to. When the group who had the injured boy were going down the same trail, it wasn't far before they reached a fork in the road. And they wanted to take the left path, which the boy scout had taken, but there were obstacles along that path. And because they were carrying the boy shoulder by shoulder, they didn't think they'd be able to get him through that way. So they decided to take the right path. And what they didn't realize was it was very much longer. So that was the reason why they didn't get back until 5:30 a.m, because it had taken them hours and hours to get back. Well, the scout leader himself, he was never suspected of anything because he'd been with the other scouts all along. So, you know, the police were trying to say, well, foul play, but he'd never left the other boys. Nobody at the base had seen the boy come back, and, you know, they used cadaver dogs and they couldn't find his body. So really they were saying, in the newspapers. Well, clearly he's been abducted, you know. And they said this mountain has always had a very strange magnetic power, and it does attract that sort of thing. And even mystics were saying, you know, that seems like it could be. But the family were engaging psychics, and although they didn't really believe in psychics, but they were asking them for any information they could give them. But every psychic they spoke to said to them, we'd only speak to the dead, so we are getting nothing from him. So he's alive. We can't communicate with him because he's alive. So, but again, it didn't lead to finding him, obviously. And the only tiny clue which this investigative journalist found years later, according to him, was that on the second night of the search party, they were in the forest and they heard a scream. The scream was followed by the sound of a whistle. And obviously the boy wore a whistle as part of his uniform. When they heard the whistle, they all ran into the area that they thought it was coming from. And as they were running, they saw a sudden flash of blue light. And then they saw it twice more, two more blue flashes. And they were shouting and whistling to him, but they never heard anything else again after that. So there's no conclusion on that one at all.
Right.
It's just one of those very, very mysterious accounts that will never really be solved.
Yeah. All right. And another weird one that has some people compared to the Dyatlov Pass incident was that of Jeanette Johnson and John Cooper, who were, this is also from South America.
Yeah, this was Argentina. And this one happened in 1973. So John Cooper was a NASA engineer. Jeanette Johnson was a teacher. And they got a group together. So there was eight of them in total. It was a lawyer, a doctor, a psychologist, a geologist. All of them got together and they planned this trip to go up Mount Aconcagua in Argentina. And it's a 22,000-foot mountain. But they decided they were going to do it in January, which, of course, is the worst possible time to do it in. And everybody tried to dissuade them and say, you're insane for attempting this, but they would not be put off. So they arrived in the town and at the base, and all of the local experts said, do not do this, you know, but they said, no, we're doing it. So they did hire a local climber called Miguel Alfonso. And Miguel again said, look, I'll go with you, but I don't recommend it. Well, they set out, and it was absolutely freezing when they set out that morning. And as the climbing progressed, it really wasn't very long before they thought that they just can't continue. The weather conditions were so appalling with the snow and the driving winds as well. But so first of all, two of the party dropped out and left and walked back to the base. And they urged the others, but they wouldn't give up. Then one more dropped out. Then another one dropped out. So the guide recalls that at this stage, they were 6,000 feet up. And the man who quit the last, he had really bad mountain sickness and he lost control of his body, basically. So the climber took him back to base and that just left four of them to carry on. And the guide says that was the last time that I saw Jeanette and John Cooper alive. He said 3 days later, we're in the base camp. There's a terrible storm. But I was looking out of the cabin and I saw two figures in the distance. And I obviously wanted to go out to help them. But he said I was forced back. The weather was so atrocious that I couldn't even get out. But I left it. And the following day, he did go out to try and help the two that were coming back. And he said when he got up to them, they were walking around in circles and babbling and they were crying. And they literally, their eyes as if they'd been blinded by the sunlight. And he said, but there should have been four of them and there was only two of them now. So he said the two that did return, and that was John Shelton and Arnold McMillan, they were in a terrible condition. They were suffering terribly from frostbite, but they were incoherent. They began shouting, Cooper is where the road nears the trees. We're not men. We're not athletes. And they were ghosts. And Jeanette has been taken by the women on mules. Well, the guide had no idea what they were talking about. And the other two never returned. So John and Jeanette never came back. And eventually, and the weather, of course, was so bad, nobody was prepared to go up and find them. And so eventually the party that was left had to just leave and go back to the States. And it wasn't until another expedition the following year that they came across the remains of John Cooper. Well, he had a strange wound in his stomach. And some have said, well, actually, that was probably caused by an ice pick. But he also had multiple fractures in his skull, and it was that that had killed him. Well, it was to be another 2 years after that before a subsequent expedition found Jeanette's body, and hers was perfectly preserved in ice. But she too had been brutally beaten and she had multiple fractures. But nobody's ever really been able to find out the reason for how they got these injuries. So the two men in the party that returned obviously said, well, there were women on mules, but how were the women on mules up there in that weather condition, and why would they have been up there so high on the mountain in such treacherous conditions? So that didn't make much sense. And they'd said, you know, that the women had taken Jeanette, but then why hadn't they taken everybody else, and why would they take them? And, you know, so were these men just hallucinating when they were talking about ghosts and mules? And, you know, I don't know. Well, and also, why didn't they kill them? Well, or had somebody else killed these two, Jeanette and John? So the formal investigation into it eventually was going to lead to them saying, well, this was clearly murder. Well, the last time that John Cooper had been seen by the other two climbers, McMillan and Seller, he was sitting up. So he was not in the condition in which he was found. He'd been left by them sitting up and leaning back against the boulder. He wasn't injured, and he was certainly not lying down with fractures. So the climbers said that they left him sitting up, and both of them, both John and Jeanette, were in a position on the mountain where there was virtually no incline. It was a 10%. So they were saying the official verdict was, well, they fell, and that's how they got their injuries, but they weren't in a position where they could have fallen. They were on a flat plain. So Jeanette was also found quite a distance away from John. So if they'd been climbing together, they'd have probably landed together, but they weren't next to each other. But they both had these multiple fractures. Well, the authorities did decide in the end. They said it's murder. They said Jeanette must have ice-picked John, and then she must have fallen. But they couldn't explain how John had the multiple fractures as well. So the forensics of the case really didn't add up with the verdict or the geography of where they were found and where they'd been climbing at the time. Well, then John Cooper was also, when he was found by this other expedition, the man who found them was called William Vieira, and he said that his hands were clenched tight as though he'd been using them to defend himself. And he said that's not the usual state. If you freeze to death, you don't freeze with your fists clenched. And Jeanette had apparently been found frozen to death, but instead of having the sort of sleepy, passive look on their face that they would expect if that was the condition that you died in, she had a look of absolute terror, apparently, you know, a death mask of terror. Well, again, they were still only found on this flat plain, so it didn't explain how they got the blows to the head, and a fall didn't seem to be possible. Well, the official report had said, well, we looked in her diary, and it seems to be that she was obsessed with getting to the top. She had once stalked an ex-boyfriend, and she had to get a restraining order because she stood outside his house for 2 days. So they were saying she was clearly obsessed with John Cooper, and she attacked him with the ice pick and killed him, and then she threw herself off something and died. But it just didn't really add up at all.
Yeah.
And then actually, it was 3 years later, another American man, he was quite a known athlete. I don't mean famous, but he was known as being athletic, you know. And he was found dead 20 metres from where John Cooper had been found.
Wow.
So, sorry to interrupt you. And also one other thing was the donkeys, they were using donkeys at the base to transport John Cooper's body, but the donkeys refused to have anything to do with it, which I thought was a bit strange as well.
Definitely, you know, has at least some vague similarity to the Outlaw of Pass as well.
Yeah, that's kind of what I thought, but it's very mysterious. It's a little bit hard to read all the information on it because it is quite sparse, but also because, again, you've got to translate it. Well, I don't translate it, but it's translated for you. So, you know, right. You have to sort of read into what does that mean? But it does seem a bit odd.
And the other story, I meant to mention this earlier, when you said they went to this army sergeant who could communicate with ETs, telepathically or whatever, and I'm thinking, yeah, that wouldn't be in the U.S. That's definitely a South American type of, you know, like, you wouldn't have a U.S. officer right. who was publicly saying, oh, yeah, I can communicate with ETs.
Oh, really? Well, it always surprises me that the Canadian man who was in the government over there, he was a defense minister, I believe, wasn't he? And he's spoken out about it, hasn't he, for years?
God, yeah.
What's his name? But like, I don't know who you're talking about. Yeah. But, oh, right, so nobody would really say it. No, that's true. Yeah, yeah.
No one in the military would admit telepathic communication, you know, in a public way. It just, they'd be immediately removed.
You're insane.
So we have one more for tonight, and this is the vanishing of student named Maura Murray.
Yeah, I think this is quite a well-known one, actually, although I'd only just come across it. But I do think, because it's so talked about in forums and things, it's one of those cases that people have always wanted to try and solve, a bit like the JonBenet Ramsey, that sort of, never-ending one that nobody can get to the bottom of. And a lot of private detectives have looked into this case. So Maura was a student nurse at Amherst University, and it was in 2004. And she had a really busy schedule. So she was doing lectures, obviously also doing nursing practice. And she had two jobs. She had a fiancé who lived out of state, and her father, who lived out of state, but he visited quite frequently. And much of her childhood had been spent hiking with him. Well, she had a job as a security personnel on the dorms itself. So one night she'd been at the post there when she'd received a telephone call that had really upset her, and her supervisor had even had to escort her back home, back to her room, because she was too upset to continue working the shift. But nobody knows what it was that was said to her in the phone call. And then the next day, she inexplicably invented a death in the family to use as an excuse to tell to her teachers, to say, I've got to leave college for a few days, and I've got to go back for a funeral, but there had been no death. So she sent these emails to her lecturers, and then she packed up her clothing, and she took pictures from her wall and about a week's worth of clothing in her gym kit, jewellery, and some of her study books. And she also took some alcohol, and she took a book about true stories of hiking in the mountains and directions about how to get to Vermont. So she got in her car and she drove off, but she wasn't far out of the area when she crashed. It was outside of Woodsville, and she'd crashed, not badly, but she just had a minor smash. So it was very cold that night, and literally just after the smash, a bus driver was driving past, and he stopped to see if she was okay, and he said, do you want me to call the police? And she said, no, I'm fine. And he said, well, even though she didn't want me to, I thought I'd better call the police anyway, because he was concerned for her safety. So his home was only a minute, literally, away from the crash site. So he got home and he called the police, and they got there within 6 minutes. But they found the car locked and she wasn't inside, and they couldn't see her anywhere. The front window had been cracked and the airbags had been deployed. So the police were thinking, well, she might be a little bit injured, she might have hit her head. So they did an initial search of the area, and then they escalated it into a full-blown search. And they had helicopters flying over, and they informed the boyfriend and the parent and the father. And the boyfriend said that he travelled up from Oklahoma pretty much immediately. But as he was travelling, he received a voicemail message that went to his phone. So he didn't answer it because he was driving, I presume. But it came from a prepaid calling card, and he could only hear breathing and crying. But he believes that it was her. Well, the thing was that she hadn't told anybody where she was going, but she had made a cryptic call to a condo rental in New Hampshire, but she hadn't booked it, but she'd inquired about it. And she'd withdrawn $500, which was probably quite a bit, but she'd also stopped on her drive that night to buy some alcohol. And when the police had got to the scene, they thought that they could find traces of spilt wine. So the idea is perhaps that she was concerned that if the police came, if the bus driver did call the police and they came, she was thinking, well, if I get a DUI, what am I going to do? So she might have run into the woods. So that was kind of perhaps the theory. And of course, she used to go hiking. So the idea was, well, she knows how to handle herself at night in the woods. But she had been drinking. So, of course, that would have made her really cold. And anyway, so really over the years and years and years, there's so many theories that have been put forward about it. And, you know, the idea is that she either ran off, but I don't think that really makes sense, or that she was taken by a serial killer. So, you know, he monitored scanners and things. But I suppose you have to think, well, really, a private investigator, actually, he sat at that spot on an anniversary of her disappearance once. And he said, well, at that time of day, that month and that time, seven cars passed. So he said, what are the chances that one of those seven cars, theoretically, would have been somebody who was going to kidnap her and take her. It's one that's never been sold. And I read that she was a West Point candidate at one point at the Naval Academy. So it's like, well, she could probably look after herself. But then if she'd been drinking and, you know, if somebody had a gun, well, of course they could take her. And somebody a few years later, I read somebody saying that they'd found a backpack in the woods. And they didn't take it. They left it there. And then they went and called the police. And they wrote about this and they said, you know, I think it's hers. It's frozen and everything, but I've told the police. But when they went back to, but they never heard back from the police. Sorry. So when they went back to the woods, they found that the rucksack was gone, but the police didn't seem to have taken it. So, but the really cryptic thing is that the dogs that were used to try and find her, they didn't find any tracks or scent leading into the woods. So in a way you kind of think, well, she probably couldn't have gone into the woods in that case, because surely they would have led into the woods. There was the idea that her father said, well, they didn't use the right piece of her clothing for it, but I think they'd have found a trace. The only possible maybe theory that it could have been was that she might have had a tandem driver, so perhaps she had planned to do it and somebody had come with her in another car, or I don't know. It's one of those things. It's one of those cases that it seems to have captured the imagination of a lot of people, because years later everybody is still sort of trying to solve it, you know. But you know, the idea that she took the book with the hiking stories in, I don't know.
It's definitely weird.
It is, and I mean, I put two or three of those in the book this time because I was finding them, and there's sort of a lot of different possible answers, you know. And you can say, well, actually, that's clearly nothing to do with any kind of alien abduction. It's not some sort of entity took her, you know. So you can say, well, maybe there's human elements sometimes in some of these stories. So it kind of shows that you have to look at every single angle, really, before you can even begin to think what happened.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so the new book is called Hunted in the Woods.
Yeah.
It is available on Amazon.
Yeah.
And we are going to do one more show with you, but it's going to be a midweek podcast, and we're going to talk about some of these drowning deaths.
Yes.
So.
Yeah. I think people must think, why do I keep putting that in the book every time? Because every time I do another book, I add to those stories and put more in there. But I think it's kind of like a pet project for me that's been going on for so long. And it's, yeah.
And there's definitely something behind it. I mean, something very sinister going on. So we will talk about that in, like I said, a midweek podcast here in another week or so.
Yeah.
And I thank you for spending so much time with us and all the work you're putting into these books. I mean, you're doing an enormous amount of research. You just keep writing.
Oh, thank you. I love doing it. I'm so passionate about it. I mean, I think it's so intriguing, all of these stories. They're so mysterious that it just captures my imagination. So hopefully, you know, it does for other people, because I never get tired of this. There's never enough to do. You can never stop.
All right. Well, thank you, Steph.
Thank you so much.
Okay, and that was part two of my conversation with Steph Young. The next part, as we were talking about there, will probably be recorded next week. I'm not sure exactly when it's going to be up, but if you're a patron, you'll get it right away as soon as it's recorded. And you can become a patron by going to wheredidtheroadgo.com. It's only $3 a month. You get some extra bits here and there. You're going to get some extra bits in specific stuff I've recorded just for patrons from various authors I've talked to, and you get anything that is recorded as soon as it's ready, rather than having to wait for it to air. So, this coming up is a good example. We're going to have this midweek podcast done. I'm not sure exactly when I'm going to put it up, but it's going to go out to patrons right away. There's also going to be some special stuff coming up for patrons only, and for only $3 a month, I'm pretty sure you're getting your money's worth. And there's just going to be more and more stuff as we go. And thanks to patrons, we've been able to do a more steady midweek podcast here. And hopefully that will keep up. All right. So, again, to take you out, this is Psyche Corporation. And that's PSYCHE Corporation. Off Crypts and Codes. Here's Nightmares.
Shut the closet door, it's under the floor, the monster's there. Don't leave me here, among these ghosts. You
Catch up to me, burn me, chew me, slake me, thrill me.
I don't want the unicorn, I want the bloodsucker, modify the uniform,
cause I'm a monster.
Of waiting for your curses to catch up to me. Bind me, chill me, slake me, thrill me.
This is a sound I've heard before. It's like a voice asking for more.
Ma chère éclate à cause des ailes.
On prend secteur de plume belle.
Give me the nightmares, cause death doesn't scare me. I want the